Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 124.EZ3629, certificate number 32944, bioplastics.
Plastic bags are a scourge to the environment. Not only do they clog up storm drains and create flooding, you know, they kill sea tortoises and dolphins and whales, but even more so, they break up into these microparticles that ends up in our drinking water.
Jeff Tittle is the director of the New Jersey Sierra Club.
I know you're concerned about the environment.
I'm pretty concerned about the environment.
I feel like for Gen Z especially, but also for younger millennials, the state of the environment is their number one issue. Their number one fear for the future, number one sense that we are on a path that's irretrievably headed toward calamity.
I almost think for me it was scarier than nuclear war.
Biocatastrophe.
Yes. Maybe because it seemed slower and more inexorable. You know, the Amazon getting gradually chipped away while and sloths dying while I sat there powerless.
Right.
That was worse than someday you could hear a air siren, air raid siren. You don't know.
Yeah, that's maybe the difference in our ages too, because I for sure had air raid siren as my primary fear until the aerosol destruction of the ozone layer became this, and that felt very sudden. We hadn't ever heard of it or considered it, and then all of a sudden there was a hole in the ozone layer over the southern hemisphere, over the South Pole, really.
Yep.
And it was creeping up through Chile and Argentina, and there was really nothing to do about it because we used aerosol cans for everything.
And unlike the Cuban Missile Crisis, this was like a science fiction movie end of the world.
Yeah. And it seemed like it had been activated and there was nothing to stop it, and it was coming soon. And this was, we've talked about all the kind of famine hysteria of the 1970s and early 80s, that what it seemed like the catastrophe was going to be was the world wouldn't be able to feed itself. Mm-hmm. And the Silent Spring, Rachel Carson, all the animals are dying and we're going to lose all these species. I mean, all this stuff was with me throughout my childhood.
Yeah, you get the echoes of the earlier stuff.
And acid rain. I mean, it was one after another kind of thing, but most of that was sort of localized. Like acid rain was going to destroy the forests around the Great Lakes. And
right. Save the whales is very limited if you're not a whale.
Right. PCBs are going to kill, or DDT is going to kill eagles and vultures. But you don't really rely on eagles and vultures.
Yeah, none of that really went to ... And then you're in a fallout shelter.
And then everyone. Yeah, right. Yeah. And it was only, the ozone layer that suddenly felt like it maybe superseded nuclear catastrophe as a global problem.
Right.
But increasingly, especially since the 2000s, the global warming or rather climate change story became less a thing that was kind of reserved for an academic audience or oh, this is sometime in the distant future, or, you know, temperatures are going to go up half a degree, to a thing that seems more and more like it's activating a lot of these things. It's going to be calamitous, things like famine, but also terrible storms.
It's got the biblical stuff, the hurricanes and the whatnot, but it also has kind of the slow inexorable, you know, refugee crises and famine and all the rest.
And it connects to other fears, like it's going to be climate change that exacerbates the lack of water in the desert Southwest. The lack of water is going to lead to massive die-offs, or it's always a die-off scenario, right?
Yeah. Once the coral reefs go, that's what, and, you know, 70% of certain kinds of ocean ecosystems rely on that, and then
we're going to lose all the fish. We're going to lose all the, and it's going to be animals then, mass die-offs, and that sense of mass calamity, and especially without the possibility of global thermonuclear war, it's become the global thermonuclear war, but one with a diffuse sense of who's responsible. In a way, right, we're all responsible, but really it's, you know, it's the big industries, massive capitalism that...
Nuclear war was almost the equivalent of a comet striking the Earth.
Yeah.
You could wake up today and it probably won't happen, but it might, and there's really no accountability, nothing you could have done differently. It's, you know, it leads to nihilism.
Right.
Whereas that's actually not true of climate change.
And it was a clash of politics that seemed like it was irresolvable, right? It's either collectivism, which is portrayed as totalitarianism, or it's capitalism, which is portrayed as unchecked exploitation. So which are you going to choose? A totalitarian collectivism or an exploitative capitalism? And throughout the Cold War, we felt like, well, capitalism isn't that exploitative. And we've seen what totalitarianism does. Now, politically, I think the young people are they don't have experience of totalitarianism other than than the police in Missouri, right, or the perception of the police in Missouri. So we don't think of collectivism as tied to totalitarianism quite the way the Cold Warriors
tied to 15 million famine deaths or whatever, right?
And capitalism seems a lot more exploitative and also not concerned with the environment, because by its very nature, the perception of corporate capitalism is that that it's unchecked. It has no concerns other than profit, and it will wreak any amount of damage, including mass die-offs of precisely the customers that it is, that it's most trying to exploit.
It does seem to be a little bit short-sighted.
That idea of corporate capitalism, global capitalism, which is not always exactly an accurate depiction of how that system works, even at its worst.
But right? they do seem focused on this quarter's profits, or, you know, what this initiative looks like to the board by the time I want to retire.
And I think the only issue is that the use of the word they in that situation is not a modern affliction, right? It's one that goes back to the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Deciding who exactly is they and how much they work in lockstep pursuing a common goal, right?
Is this problematic that I referred to CEOs as they? Am I marginalizing CEOs?
No, I don't think so. But in terms of the way we think of contemporary corporate capitalism, it has as many colors as the rainbow, and there are a lot of capitalists who think of themselves and certainly try to portray themselves as being very environmentally conscious, in addition to being corporate. And responsible, I think, is the number of corporate boards that are trying to, and sometimes earnestly trying to be responsible, is, I think, increasingly that's what the counter argument to corporate capitalism that isn't specifically anti-capitalist.
It's difficult to distinguish that kind of actual sincere policy change from what will make the public think that Exxon cares.
Right. And I think
because every company is doing that.
I think petrochemical companies often are pretty readily exposed as working against the common good in terms, and they'll call themselves green all day, and there's just no evidence behind it.
Well, I bought a car from a company that's very into the ethos of, well, you know, is this upholstery sustainable? What fibers do we repurpose that's not leather? And yet they're making cars.
Yeah.
They're making $70,000 single-use cars.
And this is the issue, right? That requires, in some ways, strip mining. It requires petrochemical processing, even at its most ecological.
And it just seems like even though I feel good driving it, I think I'm getting smokescreened.
Yeah. And you see it in all the conversation around ecological and responsible corporate practices, and you see it in home building around the city of Seattle. People will tear down a house built in 1889 out of old growth timber that has 8 bedrooms and is perfectly
1,100 square
usable,
feet,
and they'll replace it with 9 townhomes, and they'll call them green. You know, they'll say this is made out of recycled whatever McCall
it's whatever certified.
But what it does do is increase density, which is a net positive in cities. But what it isn't is green. What's green is leave the thing that's built.
Driving your gas car for 20 years is green.
Yeah.
Leasing a new Tesla every 3 years is not
green. It's not green, right? To make a Prius is a massive industrial product, and it's...
I've never done it.
Well, you've never made a Prius.
I've never made a single Prius. You know why? Because it's so hard.
The two of us have never made a Prius.
How many friends would we have to get together to make a good Prius? Like if we had a weekend.
Do we know anybody that has a smokestack? Because we're going to need like 90 smokestacks in order to really make a Prius.
Who do we know that has like rare earth mines in Africa?
Rare earths, really, you know, I don't think Africa is really the main supplier of rare earths.
Central Asia.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately.
Ecuador and Bolivia. Who do we know that can give us some Bolivian cobalt?
Let me think on that.
I think we're not going to be able to make a Prius this weekend.
Nobody ever rolled their eyes at me driving a 1979 Suburban, but I did have my little speech all prepared, waiting for somebody to yell at me about carbon emissions, because my little speech was, all the carbon munitions that went into building this thing are sunk costs from 1980, and in fact, this for its bad
fuel
efficiency is actually better for the earth. Better for the earth, Ken. That's what we're looking for. And the thing about the movement, and it right now it's kind of being overshadowed by just the overshadowed in certain media channels by a feeling that capitalism itself is irredeemable. But for a long time, the idea of arresting climate change had a component of corporate responsibility. And a lot of that got really perverted by carbon offset credits. And the government got involved and said, oh, well, you can call your thing green even though it is pouring mercury into the rivers because you bought the right to call it green from some other some trade-off with somebody that actually was green in order to, or you're paying taxes in some convoluted way.
Right.
I mean, it's...
you can buy being green.
And this is not just an American thing. This is globally, right? In Italy in 2011, they passed a law that said all shopping bags have to be biodegradable. And it's the kind of, like, shopping bags are not really the main problem with industrial waste and climate change. It's not really shopping bags that are doing it.
Stuff like that just makes it a punchline. You know, it's the new tree hugger. You know, if you're a straw banner, like, oh, well, you know, anybody who's, you know, that can't actually be a sincere or helpful initiative because it's just such a nibble around the edges, stupid thing. You're going to make people madder that their straws suck than you are going to do any good.
Here in Seattle, of course, we're a very progressive city.
Congrats.
We're an ivory tower. sitting out here on the coast, one of the coast, the cities full of coastal elites.
The water wars will come here last.
And
it's very damp.
Because we're liberals, we are shooting ourselves in the foot constantly.
Nobody else to fight with. Yeah, it's all infighting.
But also, you know, we've legalized drugs and you can just walk around in your underpants now. There's no law, really. This is the perception from both the middle of America and I think all of Russia, that we
have. All of Russia hates Seattle and Portland?
Yeah, I think they do. Or if not all of Russia, I think the people in the high tower in Russia certainly are using that as a propaganda war.
Well, I don't want anybody with ICBMs to think that Seattle and Portland are the problem. I want people with ICBMs to think New York is the problem.
come on.
LA.
Our friends in New York. Well, okay, I won't defend LA. But we've recently experienced a real shocker when we realized that recycling itself was kind of a chimera. Most of the stuff we thought we were recycling was being shipped across the ocean to an Asia that didn't want it anymore and couldn't profit from...
Garbage offsets, basically.
Right. Couldn't profit from recycling it, and so we're just dumping it in the ocean somewhere else.
Now, I still have all the good emotions that I had from separating the recycling, so there is that.
I do, too.
Recycling had vibes going for it.
Recycling did have vibes.
It turned out, but outside of what, glass and aluminum, it wasn't super efficient.
And so within recycling, there are... I mean, the ideal of recycling, as embodied by the symbol of that beautiful symbol of recycling, which is three bent arrows in a triangle of that's a continuous loop.
You need three people to recycle. Two people cannot recycle.
Well, you need to be able to hand your piece of garbage to someone else who will also use it as a piece of garbage until they hand it to someone else, and then when it comes back to you, it still has the same value and utility as it did when it left your hands.
It does make me wonder why I handed it off in the first place then, if I was later going to want it back.
Well, the thing about, and so this is called closed loop recycling, which is a concept and, you know, and it's a utopian concept, but one that in certain systems has been shown to be possible, which is that the raw materials that go into making a thing are sort of somewhat perfectly collectible. When the thing is done being used, it can be recycled into those components. Those components can go into making a thing that has the same utility as the thing that you once used.
100% of the aluminum in that can go to a new can.
That's right. And the new can, the aluminum in the process of being converted from your old can to a new can, no quality of the aluminum is lost, right? The fibers don't break down until they become just mush and aren't usable anymore.
Right. And we're not breaking the laws of thermodynamics. We know that right. there is going to be some energy coming into the system to recycle the damn thing.
That's right.
But there's no net loss of the stuff.
Of the stuff itself. And ultimately, the goal would be that energy to recycle the material would be recaptured energy, right? That somehow the energy that is in it perfectly is, I mean, and again, you're...
Or at least somehow renewable.
Yeah, this is breaking the laws of thermodynamics, but to as great a degree as possible, the energy can be recaptured as well. But this is not... Here's where capitalism comes in. This is not profitable yet. It is still much easier to make new stuff and throw it away than it is to take old stuff and turn it back into new stuff. And that profit motive, the technology is pretty far ahead of the economic practicality. So we can, for instance, recycle a lot of that stuff, but it's still cheaper to make it. And if we lived in a utopian totalitarian society where that was mandated, or a capitalist but parochial, patriarchal kind of socialist economy.
Some enlightened Scandinavian capitalism.
Where there were tax breaks for that kind of work rather than tax breaks for farmers to pour their milk down the drain or tax breaks for companies to make stealth bombers. If we redirected our tax infrastructure and our basically where we use our wealth into subsidizing that kind of stuff. This is the larger climate change argument about capitalism, which is just that we do prop up capitalism all over the place.
What should we throw the money at?
But let's throw that money at making these processes more affordable.
I guess the problem is by the time that scarcity, I'm assuming that in a lot of industries, like by the time that scarcities make it more profitable to reduce, reuse, recycle than just make a new widget, you've already got problems.
Yeah.
You've already driven up costs. And
if you think about the petro dollars, the petrochemical dollars, and also just fuel, gasoline, and I mean, we're talking about fossil fuels. Fossil fuels is a limited resource. But it's not limited enough. There's still plenty of fossil fuels to – we can continue to extract and exploit them probably past some even larger tipping point of like this has created an untenable amount of pollution and garbage.
Yeah, and the side effects of – you know, because increasingly there's unforeseen side effects of – as scarcities grow, you get – whatever the side effects of fracking are, you know, less efficient kinds of materials harvesting, right?
Right, right. And also, you know, the squandered resource of already made material.
Yeah.
I mean, part of the philosophy behind my supertrain concept, as elucidated on my other podcast, Roderick on the Line, for those of you who want to get deep into my philosophy of the world in the future – I don't recommend it. I don't think if you're not already.
Wait, even you are not recommending.
No.
Who do you expect to recommend your podcast?
If not you. If you've been
I'm not going to.
Listening to it for 10 years, then you know that's sunk cost. But starting it now, it's really a lot. But the idea of trash as a resource, consumed material, already produced material. That actually is maybe easier to access the wealth of raw material in it than it would be to extract more of it from the earth and process it.
Get it from a dump instead of a mine.
Yeah. And that is, you know, the opposite – or not the opposite, but a different our current practice of recycling is not the closed loop – recycling represented by that wonderful graphic, but it's open loop recycling, which is, you know,
I'm going to try to draw it
within this process.
Like, is it still the three arrows, but other stuff's coming in at all three junctures?
Well, yeah, that there is waste and degradation of material.
Oh, yes. So at all three vertexes, stuff goes in and stuff goes out.
Yeah. Stuff has to come in to keep that cycle moving. And there is waste that isn't recovered that ends up in landfills, but also in the ocean, in the air. It's what we're concerned about, garbage, trash, and pollution. Pollution being a separate category from garbage, which is a separate category from trash.
I always think of pollution as air pollution.
But ocean pollution, right. As you mentioned before, is
yeah, is ocean that. Pollution trash or is it pollution to you?
Well, there's two kinds, right? There's chemical pollution of the oceans that often comes from fertilizer.
Right.
That creates algal blooms, that makes the jellyfish go bonkers, that, you know, that makes the ocean an anaerobic environment, and especially close to the continents,
yep.
Which is where a lot of the life is.
Was.
And then there's trash, which is big gyres or gyres, depending on which Irish poet you are quoting, of just plastic that's degrading, but only degrading into microplastic.
It's just going to spread out more.
Yeah.
The plastic's never going anywhere.
And the thing about microplastic is a lot of the a lot of the panic around it is that we're worried it's coming back to us in the form of food. The fish who are eating microplastics, well, the jury's kind of out on, I mean, the fish will just, you know, the way evolution works, it's every 2 years creatures evolve.
Well, we're speaking to the we're speaking to the fish that learn to ingest plastic into their exoskeletons.
Yeah, and now they're half plastic, but they still live and breathe.
They can, because they can live in a world without coral reefs because they got that efficient plastic armor.
Exactly.
Good job.
But recently, even more recently than recycling, but it predates our fear that recycling doesn't work. There's a new category of material that's entered our industrial and, you know, global consumer universe, which are bioplastics. Now, let me ask you how you feel about bioplastics. Do you consume bioplastics? Do you, are you excited when you encounter bioplastics, and do you prefer them to regular plastics?
I don't know if I have enough hands-on experience. I remember when Lego announced they were going to try to get rid of petroleum, but, you know, they had a hard date. You know, they're Scandinavians.
Yes, they are.
So they're like, by the year 2028, there will not be any petroleum in Lego plastic. We need a bio alternative. And apparently they're ahead of schedule on that. Those, the crafty Danes.
Yes.
Are figuring out how to make Legos out of corn and beef tallow or something. And I have no idea. Is this good? Is this bad? You still have to grow the corn. You still have to pull the beef tallow off your beeves.
You know, the Danes don't have a ton of oil.
Right.
They're not a major producer of petroleum.
They're right next to the Norwegians who do, and it's really got to gall them.
Yeah, it does. You know, in all of Scandinavia, the language that the other countries want to learn is Swedish.
Why is that?
Because the Swedes are the cool ones, I guess.
It's just ABBA.
And then within Sweden, the language that they all want to learn is Swedish, because there are a lot of new residents of Sweden, a lot of immigrants who also are trying to learn Swedish. Everybody up there wants to learn Swedish. Maybe they already know English.
Well, it's in the middle. Maybe it's the average of all the other languages.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if you put Norwegian and Danish together, you get Swedish.
I don't think of the Norwegians as wanting to learn Swedish, but...
No, they hate the Swedes, right?
Yeah, right. I think the Danes.
And they don't need to, because they've got all the North Sea oil. They're like, screw you guys. We're looking west. Is that what they say?
Screw you guys. It's my Norwegian accent. Ken, we encourage people to support the show by joining our Patreon. And our Patreon offers a lot of benefits above and beyond just the good feeling
that comes with supporting great art.
Supporting great art. Can you tell us some of the benefits of supporting our Patreon?
Well, there are multiple tiers. You know, historically, for contributing $5 a month, you get a bonus episode, kind of our best perk at the lowest level, an addenda show.
An addenda show every month where we answer reader mail.
If you give $10 a month, you get that, and you get access to the Patreon feed where we put up photos of show notes and the weird things people send us, and a renewed commitment to post other kind of visual stuff. John and I were just talking about this.
Yeah, we're going to start posting a lot more photographs and selfies. Candid shots of us at the beach.
At the $20 level, you get signed show notes.
Actual physical notes sent to your home.
Once a year, we'll send you signed notes from one of the shows we recorded. If there's ever a shortage in subsequent years, you might get assigned something else weird. We've been sending out chick tracts to a lot of repeat donors.
You can absolutely request certain shows if we still have them available. Right?
And at the $50 level, that's the Washing Bear tier. This year, you get a cool exclusive Washing Bear t-shirt. In future years, that tier name will change and a different organism will appear on your shirt of the year.
Sentient clams.
Yeah, it'll always be a mollusk, of course.
Sure.
It'll always be seafood. And the $100 level, John and I record you a fun, cool video message. We can take requests for that. But the reason why we're recording this whole spiel is because we have just bulked up, you might have heard, our introductory $5 tier. It was already the best tier because it had the addenda show.
But well, I mean, every tier gets everything that's on the $5.
Oh, yeah, tier. I forgot to keep doing that. It's a 12 Days of Christmas scenario.
That's right.
Not only do you get 11 Lords of Leaping, you get 5 Golden Rings.
And four Calling Birds.
And a Partridge in a Pear Tree. So all the tiers, but even the lowly $5 folks, the humblest widow's mite donors, scraping together $5
A month. Our home boys and girls, our home bros.
They will also receive, going forward, VIP access to each new omnibus entry.
That's right.
What does that mean, John?
It means that you will get the show 2 days prior to when it airs to the hoi polloi.
Drops on Thursday for the regulars, drops it Tuesday for you.
Tuesday for $5 donors or above. And also, it will be ad-free. No advertisements. You don't have to fast-forward through Ken's and my hair replacement ads and mattress shilling.
You can still, now if you love that stuff, you if you're like, I don't want to miss out on the new advances in buckwheat sleepwear.
Right.
That, you can still listen to that on Thursday when the new show drops.
That's right.
But you will have the option to opt out of the ads you don't like.
And total bragging rights. You can go on the internet and just start spoiling the whole episode. You can say, haha, they don't get to the topic until 40 minutes in.
Hey, Thursday people, I know who the killer is.
Lol. And there's nothing they can do to stop you.
No, Thursday people are powerless.
Yeah.
They could have become Patreon supporters.
And we're, you know, we don't want to just start calling all the, like, the shirkers Thursday people, but that might actually turn into a global coinage. It might become a meme.
Instead of like, freeloader?
Oh, what's up, Thursday people?
Like, you give a bad tip at a restaurant and the server will be like, look at this Thursday guy.
What the hell, Thursday people? You know, why don't you try and be a Tuesday people for once?
Be a little bit Tuesday. You're a Thursday person in a Tuesday world, man.
That's the thing. Gen Z's
gonna... The vibes
are
off. They're going to be like, you get a bad tip and somebody's going to be like, it's giving Thursday.
Yeah, or they might even be, you know what they'll do? They'll say, that's so Thurs. Why don't you be twos?
Thursds. So go to patreon.com/omnibusproject and become a better person, a Tuesday person, if you will.
Yeah, that's right. Be a twos, not a Thurs. Well, let me ask you, if you go to a restaurant and they give you a paper straw, you're pretty bummed.
I like the cornstarch ones. They hold up better. The waxy paper ones are the worst. They're just going to fall apart in my mouth before I'm done with my Coke.
But do you encounter things like, for instance, dog poop bags that are green colored that say bio?
We have those. Mm-hmm. They also kind of feel like they have a weird kind of corn-based quality. Like they're much closer. You know, the plastics we had as kids, I almost thought were like, you know, they might as well be wood or rock or something. You know, they just seemed like an immovable substance that came like that.
Yeah.
And would last forever, whereas these modern plastics seem more analogous to a breakfast bar of some kind, like they're
kind of crumbly,
crumbly and fibery.
You see more and more like fast food or picnic plates and forks and knives that are being sort of advertised as bio.
They seem plastic. They seem a little more brittle.
Yes.
And I guess, but it's still bad. I still feel guilty using all that single-use stuff.
You do.
I think. Am I supposed to?
Yes.
Okay, good.
Good job, Ken.
Because what I should really be doing is like just bringing a fork and then washing the fork.
This is the thing, right? The old disposable plastics of our childhood that were actually pretty substantial, those would have been wonderful if we used them again, which we certainly could have done.
Did you know families that put plasticware in the dishwasher?
I didn't know.
I knew cheapskate moms that would put plasticware in the dishwasher.
I mean, we do have plastic food containers here that are basically Tupperware that we think of as part of the household dishware, I guess, that we use over and over.
But they do kind of sell those as like single, you know, it's the equivalent of a Ziploc bag, right? Here's kind of a cheap sealing Tupperware thing that you're kind of encouraged to toss after one use?
My daughter's mother actually washes out those big gallon Ziploc bags and uses them again.
I think I feel guilty when I don't.
Yeah. Do you?
No, yeah. because you feel weird if you do, but guilty if you don't. But like a lot of times they'll just have, I was like, what was in here? Oh yeah, you know, it had...
Peanut butter and jelly.
Yeah, it had like a sandwich in there and now it's a little bit dusted with flour. Like there's no reason you couldn't put veggies in there.
But what's really important for you is that you fill up that guilt bucket.
Yes.
Yes.
I'd rather not.
No.
I don't want the guilt. I'm not like that.
No.
I'd rather be doing the right thing.
Well, what I am here to tell you, this is a chemistry adjacent episode. I'm not going to get into the chemistry too far, except just to say chemistry words, but
to mispronounce chemistry words.
To mispronounce chemistry words.
Got it.
But the thing about petroleum plastics is that they are bioplastics.
Because they were ferns once.
They were.
And possibly dinosaurs.
All we're talking about is polymers that are created by processing and taking those from fossilized ferns or taking them from recently grown potatoes in some ways is just a kind of chemistry semantics. There are plenty of polyesters that can be produced from corn and potatoes and sugar and fat that are, for all intents and purposes, indistinguishable from polyesters that are made from
some algal bloom from the Paleozoic.
That's right. That has been processed through the petrochemical industry with all of its attendant pollutions. The recent rise of bioplastics, it actually started, the first production of plasticky commodities from foodstuffs and sugar, it dates to the late 19th century. It wasn't, and it's been a gradual process of introducing new products. Bakelite is one.
Is Bakelite made from new stuff?
It was made by Mr. Bakel. Bakelite is made out.
It's not made of oil from the ground.
I mean, Bakelite is basically made out of wood pulp or wood, processed wood, fermented wood, and coal tar. So it's not like made out of flowers, but it's also not strictly made out of petroleum.
Yeah, celluloid, same way.
Yeah.
Camphor and nitrocellulose. Yeah, it's wood chips and stuff.
But in fact, the first company to ever be founded entirely on the premise of bioplastics, it didn't come into the world until 1983. It was a company called Marlboro Biopolymers, and their idea was, this is a new idea.
And is this a reaction
to bioplastics?
Is this a reaction to eco fears? We're running out of fossil fuels. Fossil fuels are bad. Like, is it either of those things?
Not yet. Not so much as it is. We're now developing technology to use what are food wastes. The industrial kind of agricultural offset, or the garbage that we're producing as a subset of agriculture, we're going to turn that into new products.
It would be perfect, right? If it was just the leavings.
Yeah,
if it
that's
was just
right.
Compost pile, coffee grounds, and potato peels that are going to become matchbox cars.
Sure, it's found resources out of waste. It's what we always hope for from recycling. Marlboro Biopolymers did not survive. And in fact, a lot of those early companies that came into this marketplace just found that it wasn't it wasn't economically sustainable.
They were ahead of their time.
But there is a wonderful argument for bioplastics in the sense that biochemicals, ones produced from potatoes and wood fibers and even straw, plant starch, food waste, vegetable fats. I mean, all this stuff is garbage,
mm-hmm.
and took a lot of resources to produce, and it more than anything, is a renewable resource, potentially renewable forever.
Closed loop.
Yeah, it does not require that we extract it from the ground.
It doesn't take hundreds of millions of years to form.
It doesn't. And so from an economic standpoint and a global kind of corporate economic standpoint, there are a lot of advantages to it, because not only is petroleum a non-renewable resource, and I mean fossil fuels, but also fossil fuels, as you know, are subject to global politics in addition to global financial movements. There are more fossil fuels in Saudi Arabia than there are in Denmark, and that requires that the globe negotiate with Saudi Arabia. And as that expands outward, I mean, the United States has arguably started...
How many wars?
2 to 19 wars over, over petrochemicals.
Whereas you can't be an emir of potato peels.
Not yet.
Not yet.
But from an ecological standpoint, a lot of what is now being produced as bioplastics are plastics. In order to take that material, that biological material, and turn it into usable plastics, usable, consumer goods, that stuff requires enough chemical processing that, from the standpoint of whether or not it breaks down in compost, whether or not it pollutes the oceans, whether or not it fills up landfills,
it's just as bad as...
It's just the same, whether or not it's bad. And often the way we treat petrochemical plastics, I mean, most of the laws around landfills say expressly that the landfills need to be covered in such a way that they're deprived of light and oxygen and groundwater.
And those are the things that break down
100%
plastics. And plastics are hard to recycle anyway, because there's just such so many different types of them, right? Yeah. Among other things, it's difficult to sort at any level.
It's impossible to sort, really. And what's crazy about plastic sorting is that when you introduce bioplastics into a plastic sorting situation, the bioplastics are not processed the same way that fossil plastics are processed, and bioplastics actually pollute the process.
All the current plastic recycling infrastructure that's in place is being messed up by new bioplastics.
So if you put your bioplastics into plastic recycling, it requires that they then sort that stuff out.
Am I supposed to compost my bioplastics?
So most bioplastics are not compostable.
Come on.
I'm afraid so.
It's true that what I'm saying is I want a straw that holds up just like a plastic one, and yet it magically returns to Mother Earth when my Coke is gone.
Right.
And that's hard.
The closer the bioplastic resembles plastic, the more it is plastic and not bioplastic.
Yeah.
There are a lot of bioplastics bioplastics that are really not biodegradable at all. Anything that's called a bio-PET, a bio-PE, they're chemically identical. Then there's partially biodegradable, or what's known as durable bioplastics. And what makes them durable is that although they do degrade, it takes months of work by microorganisms, and it also often requires a high heat environment, right? What breaks it down is heat, light and air, that can only be accomplished at industrial scales. It's not like the heat of being at the bottom of your compost pile. It needs to be, again, process.
But sitting in the dirt in the woods, that just acts like a regular plastic. It'll never get hot enough to break down.
That's right. And so it's just plastic. What's nice is that if your city does have industrial yard waste composting as part of its recycling universe, those facilities are capable to some degree of recycling that material. So if you throw it in your yard waste, depending on what it is, if you throw non-biodegradable plastics in your compost, you might as well just be throwing plastics in there. But there are some of these durable bioplastics, they can be processed.
But they require probably a lot of energy, right? In the form of heat and whatever the chemical processing requirements are.
A tremendous amount of energy, both in terms of the identifying it as compostable and then processing it separately from just banana peels.
Because I understood that this was a big problem with recycling, not just that it's not economically feasible, not just that you can make a new one cheaper, but actually the amount of energy that needs to be brought into the system to create, you know, to perform the recycling, it's more similar to ethanol. You're actually at a net loss efficiency-wise, even if you get to use that stuff again.
Now, the hopeful side of this is that the idea that a lot of this waste, food waste, and, you know, and bioplastics can be converted into energy because there's energy within them, yeah. Right? There's a lot of all these polymers do have potential energy in them. There just aren't any power plants yet that are configured to use this material. And also, what you're doing is you're breaking it down. But not in, there's not a net, this is an open loop recycling. It's just, I mean, what are you going to do? You're ultimately going to burn it.
Does this technology exist, or are we saying someday we have to invent power plants that can extract energy from these things? Do we know how to do it?
This technology is nascent, yeah. Right? I mean, there are a lot of people working on it. Whether or not, and ultimately, I think you can look into the future and see, like, yes, right now it's too expensive, but a lot of things used to be too expensive. It used to be too expensive to put a man on the moon until we did it. It's now too expensive again.
Then it abruptly became too expensive again.
Right. But you know, you're seeing now what the current future of bioplastics are, is that a lot of companies are either realizing that a waste component of what they already make has value if it's processed into a bioplastic. Now, this is not a save the earth motivation. This is a, why are we throwing this away when we could be making it into,
well, I honestly prefer those,
other garbage.
Because you don't have to talk anybody into government subsidies. That's for right. Those.
The South American sugar industry has started taking a lot of their sugar byproducts, and they're really ramping up the production of PHB, which is basically a kind of not really biodegradable plastic.
Plastic-ish.
It's plastic-ish. The issue right now is that agricultural production is arguably
worse for the earth.
Worse for the earth. Well, that's right.
When you mentioned South American sugar planters, I'm like, wait, I don't think we should be cheering for these
guys.
Whose
side are we on?
I mean, is that true? If the issue is deforestation, for example.
Yes, I mean, that's exactly right.
At least the oil is coming out of the barren sands of Saudi Arabia or something.
Yeah, and it's not just that we are we're taking arable land and converting it into this stuff, but also fertilizer and all of the pollution that goes into planting and harvesting, all of the kind of the runoff into the oceans, the methane that's produced. I mean, agriculture is a major producer.
Car exhaust is not like the sole way to change climate, right?
Right. I mean, the number one current petroleum-based plastic is polyethylene.
Good old polyethylene.
Polyethylene.
Every childhood toy.
It comprises right now 34% of the total plastics market. That's 100 million tons of polyethylene produced every year. And almost all of it goes into packaging. These are known as commodity plastics. And these are...
It's your water bottles.
This is your water bottles. It's all the... Every time you order something from Amazon, there's 11 layers of plastic now that are all impossible to get into somehow. My mom was saying the other day, it used to be that things that were in plastic, you could open the plastic. And now you have to get a pair of scissors or a knife out just to open like any light simple
bulbs.
Thing.
I was like, boy, they really don't want me using these light bulbs.
Because
they?
They're covered in plastic, right? And a lot of that
very
is
thick,
polyethylene. Yeah. Now, that's 100 million tons. And that's 34% of the plastic market. Polypropylene is the second largest. That's 20% of the plastics we make. Polypropylene is very close chemically to polyethylene. It's a little bit harder. It's more heat resistant. So a lot of the packaging you get that has hot food, it's probably polypropylene. But also, if you're a cross-country skier and you're using those wonderful long underwear that wick away perspiration, that's polyethylene. I'm sorry, polypropylene.
Can you make polyesters from almost any of these things?
Yeah, polyesters are basically a polymer. So and
making a long fiber out of whatever the stuff is?
Yeah, there are chemists right now among our close friends, and plenty of futurelings are chemists, and they want to tell us all about the chemistry of polyester and polymers. I'm not letting them do that because we have a parasocial relationship and this is a one-way broadcast.
Well, also, we don't care. If they were saying something interesting, we might give them a microphone.
Yeah, we kind of
I mean,
care. What they should do is start a chemistry podcast.
How much do you care about the chemical structure of polyester?
Me?
Yeah.
Well, a like lot.
For me, it's like a 2 or 3 tops.
Is that right?
Out of 100.
The thing is, to replace that 100 million tons of polyethylene and polypropylene, to replace, and the statistic was based on the idea of replacing 250 million tons of petroplastics every year.
With bioplastics.
With bioplastics. Would require that we convert 7% of all the arable land on Earth to just manufacturing the corn and straw and potato crapola.
So it's never going to happen with leavings.
No.
There's not enough vegetable waste in the world to make...
Well, even if
7% of arable, that's what I'm saying.
It's, yeah, even if we were just growing this, the potatoes themselves.
Because when you have to grow them just for this, I feel like that's bad. That's everybody already knows. Like you can't just power your car on corn because
right.
It's harder to grow corn than it is to get gas otherwise.
There's starch is a big component in making these polymers.
And in my diet.
And in your diet. Thermoplastic starch is... You know, starch that has been chemically converted by adding things like glycerol and glycol and sorbitol to it to make it moldable and castable. And this is the stuff that I mean, we think of starch. When I pick up one of those forks and it says bioplastics, I think, well, this is just potatoes that have been molded into a fork. But in molding them into a fork and getting it to stay a fork,
you add dozens of additives.
You convert it into a thing that now is going to float out into the ocean and gradually turn into little bits of potato fork that don't help the fish anymore.
And maybe the production of those additives is, you know, just as environmentally unsavory as anything else, right?
Or potentially worse.
Hmm.
So the rise of bioplastics, in my experience, is a palliative for a lot of people because it says bio in the name, and it does feel to me at least intuitive that that would be the next step in terms of eliminating plastic from our industrial chain and our consumer chain to make these things that don't turn into trash. But really, that's the benefit to us is that it's a supply chain issue. It gets us off of petrochemicals and their ugly processing, and it becomes more sustainable in the sense that anybody can produce bioplastics. You're no longer fracking.
You've solved some of the geopolitical problems. But you haven't actually solved any of the broader efficiency and energy problems, right?
Right. And what it boils down to, once again, is that the solution to this kind of plastic waste is to reuse things.
Because that's the great thing about plastic. It's so durable that if it's sitting in a landfill, that's a bummer. But if you can reuse it or turn it into a new widget, then the durability is actually the lack of decomposition is an asset.
That's right. And what I think is maybe misunderstood or there's a lack of understanding about plastics, reusable plastics, is that capitalism is not industrial capitalism, global capitalism, is not against...
Right, it's not purely extractive.
It's not intrinsically against reusing plastics.
It's wherever the profit is.
That's right. And to not be required to make all this disposable crapola out of whatever material, but instead to actually get closer to a closed-loop system is more efficient at every level. The only people that would be opposed to it are, once again, Exxon, who we all know is a thing that we are morally obligated to try and defeat at every cost.
But also to use several times a month.
To be using in every way, all around us, the petrochemical products are still a massive part of our world.
Is this psychologically compelling to you because you're also a person that likes to keep old stuff around in hopes that someday you'll find a new use for it? Do you feel like this argument for reuse actually validates your lifestyle?
Well, unfortunately, it has taken me years to... Boy, I'm really creaking today. It has taken me years to adopt a water bottle as a part of my life, right? I didn't drink water out of one-use, like, half-liter water bottles.
Yeah.
I always hated that. But I didn't get one of those liter-sized plastic... What are those things called? The universal sort of hippie water bottle thing. So the scare 10 years ago was that some of the chemicals in plastic water bottles, BPA, actually were hormonally active.
Yeah, it's going to leach into the water and turn your kids into iguanas or something.
Yeah, and there's still a lot of research into the idea that that in the industrialized world, actually globally now, the age of first menstruation in girls has been dropping and, you know, used to be 13 and now in a lot of places it's 10 years old.
And it turns out it's not going to be dairy hormones. It's actually going to be...
That's right.
your plastic or your water bottle.
It was dairy hormones for a long time. That was the panic. And now it's this kind of plastic actually functions as estrogen in... young women, and I guess maybe probably somebody's, you know, Jordan Peterson is mad that it's feminizing our men, I guess.
Yeah, it's turning the frogs gay.
I'm sure it is. But BPA-free, dishwasher-safe water bottles are really all the rage with people that bicycle commute to work and people that have those puffy jackets that are now the colors of the German flag.
Cotopaxi.
And this material is called Triton copolyester, and it's a plastic water bottle that you use for years. And weirdly, the plastic eventually gets kind of cloudy from use, and it looks gross. But that's what hippies like. They like to look gross because gross is virtuous. And I've been practicing that policy for decades.
But I feel like my problem is I do not accrete one of these things. Somehow my household has 9 of them and I didn't choose this. They got given to me or they appeared or maybe we could just solve the problem if everyone just had like 0.1 to 1 of everything instead of between 1 and 50 of everything like I currently do.
Well, this is the thing. There is an ideal state, which is that I guess we all carry messenger bags that have effectively like army mess kits, a plate, a fork.
They're all made of aluminum.
A spoon and a water bottle. And that's really not that hard. What it doesn't connote right now is wealth.
Yeah.
But there is a way, I think more than companies trying to make bioplastics out of potatoes, somebody needs to really invent one of these Instagram companies. You know, my Facebook feed is full of people trying to tell me that a certain kind of boot is going to make me look like a superstar. But what we need is to really adopt the idea that carrying your own plate and glass and silverware is
what the Kardashians do.
Yeah, that is like so cool and so rich and just like so awesome.
I will do it. I will be the TV millionaire who starts putting his Ziploc bags in the dishwasher.
Well, yes. I love this.
I volunteer as tribute.
When I put my daughter's lunch together for school, I feel a lot of pressure about not sending any trash. No, as few plastic bags as I can, and mostly reusable, snap-tight containers that we will wash and put away and use again.
Yes.
And that sort of virtue signaling that I'm doing to the grown-ups at my daughter's school, who I think are hovering over her lunch and wondering, you know, even though her other students are probably eating Oreos and barfing them right on the floor, covering the plastic they came in, I'm always trying to be the... But I don't myself think about plastic packaging, because every time I open a box from Amazon...
I didn't choose this, but here it is.
Yeah, the plastic in there could fuel my car for a week, probably, if I could convert it back to petroleum.
Amazon's been bragging lately about how good its plastic is. Like, now we're using these. These are so much less raw materials than our cardboard boxes did.
But a lot of that is, and I'm encouraging everyone listening to this show to now examine things that are called bioplastics and do a little bit of research to determine whether the bio in that means that they're absolutely compostable and taking plastic out of the equation, or whether the bio is actually a component of Amazon's supply chain politics, where, you know, they have found a way to make plastic more locally and arguably more efficiently if you don't take into consideration the pollution and energy that goes into agriculture.
They're just looking at what's cheaper, I assume. You've taken away that good feeling I have when I drink from a straw I don't like, John. I felt so good. I was like, this straw sucks, but boy, is it just going to melt back into Mother Earth in the form of individual corn molecules, corneum, and now I don't think this anymore.
The people I'm really trying to reach are the ones who have been throwing basically plastic forks into their compost pile and wondering why those plastic forks are still in some way plastic forks.
In a thousand years, those are going to be the arrowheads of the American West. I found another plastic fork. I think it's Dixie. And that concludes Bioplastics, entry 124.EZ23629, certificate number 32944. In the omnibus. Listeners, by no means should you expose yourself to social media in any way.
Don't do it.
John and I did, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick, and on Omnibus Project, and we barely survived to tell the tale.
We're very sorry. We're very sorry that we inflicted our social media on you and that it was inflicted upon us.
All the social media sites should be replaced with just a "we are very sorry" screen. You know, in the same way that Germany and Japan were forced to institutionalize regret for decades.
The Germans really embraced it and the Japanese really didn't.
Yeah, the Twitter logo should be as illegal as the swastika. Anyway, but stay away from social media, really because of all the swastikas that are now there. It's all full circle.
That's where swastikas found a safe haven.
Speaking of recycling, you could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. That's pretty efficient.
I encourage that.
Speaking of inefficiency, you could send us physical objects through the mail, but, you know, reduce, reuse, recycle.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe one of these things will have a new life. If you send it to P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155. For example, what have we here?
What have we here?
Looks like Kylie actually wants me to sign this.
Oh, you don't like that, do you?
No, I like when it's artisanal. Like, I don't like the ones where it's clearly somebody who owns a sports card store in Florida, and it's just going to show up on eBay the next day.
Right.
But, like, if you can sign something and actually feel like this is going to make a kid happy. No better moment in my day.
But how much work do you have to put in to discern whether it's a nice thing or a bad thing?
I don't have a good solution. It's like sorting recycling.
Yeah.
I do not have an efficient system right now to be like, this one's going to make a kid happy.
So what is this telling you by looking at it? What are some of the signs, some of the signals that this is a good thing, not a bad thing?
It comes with a handwritten letter that is not just like, here, all the fake ones are like this. I am so impressed by all your accomplishments, because they want to be able to send it to musicians and athletes and singers.
Yeah. I just got a text message on my phone that said, hi. And it's like, yeah, uh-huh, I see you.
And it's always, could you sign three of these for me and my two nephews?
Oh, yeah.
Because they always want you to imagine the happy children.
Yes.
There are no happy children. This stuff's going on. But this is all very artisanal, because it includes, I asked Bing Chat to write a poem about you, and then she included the poem about me. She also included, and this is very rare, a gift for me. It appears to be a homemade calendar of either plastic or possibly AI-generated horses.
Okay.
Each one decorated with an inspirational quote, some from Emerson, some from the Bible, one from Wanderlust by Paul McCartney. It's Wanderlust for me. Can't wait to get to November.
And those are AI-generated horses, you think?
I now think they're actually close-ups of plastic toy horses.
Oh, that's cool. So it's like an art project thing.
Well, they looked all weird and shiny, and I was like, oh, this is like Dolly. But no, I think it is an art project of cheap toy plastic horses. I don't know who made this, but maybe Kylie did. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kylie.
I think I will.
I didn't get a
Bing written poem about you that begins with 74 wins in a row. He's proved himself to be quite the pro.
Couldn't disagree.
How come they can do rhyme but not meter? That's what I'm wondering about AI.
Is that true? I haven't been following their poetry. AIs.
Well, listen.
AIs is
with 74 wins in a row. He's proven himself to be quite the pro.
74
it doesn't scan.
Wins in a row. He's proven himself to be quite the pro.
I mean, if you did that.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm a rapper, so.
But Ken's your flow is amazing. But Ken's more than just a game show star. He's an author, a father, and a podcast czar.
But Ken is more than a game show
that
star.
That one works. He's got a heart that's big and true, and he'll always be there for you. Mm-mm. See, I mean, in rock, you can do that. You can end a line prematurely. But AI doesn't know that. Kylie, thank you. I will sign your things. But then there's a big pile of
like 19
of cards on my desk.
19 photographs of you.
No.
Headshots.
There's just one. And there was something else. Wasn't there something else here I was going to open? Oh, yeah. Here it is.
Our flight to adventure? No.
Larry, kind of. Larry Lake from Illinois, like all people of a certain generation, has a house full of old-timey like maps and railway brochures.
That's rad.
And they are really, I was just looking at them. California via the Pacific Northwest with lots of period photographs.
Like a trip you would go on.
People enjoying their roomettes. Yeah, exactly. Although, if you're going from Chicago to California, this is really trying to sell you on the Olympian Hiawatha so you can see Montana.
Yeah, Empire Builder.
I guess.
I mean, it's pre-Empire. Or no, it's a different railroad line. That's the Milwaukee Rail or something like that.
A great train, a glorious route.
That is a glorious route.
You pass beautiful Lake Catchelas, go through 2-mile-long Snoqualmie Tunnel.
We call that Catchelas.
You say Catchelas? Have I been saying it wrong?
Well, my dad always said Catchelas, and I don't argue with him because he's dead.
I guess it can't be Catchelas because the two E's are like in the first syllable.
Yeah, it doesn't look like it should be Catchelas, but that's what they always said. The problem with going from Chicago to the Pacific Northwest on the Milwaukee Rail is that there's a lot of the Dakotas and then eastern Montana you have to get through.
They're not really lingering on that.
Yeah, it's beautiful-ish.
You can see why this brochure emphasizes the Pacific Northwest part of the itinerary. Here's a Grand Canyon Zion Bryce Canyon itinerary.
Nice.
Here's the Milwaukee Road. Ooh, you can.
Oh, I was right.
You can save 1/5 to 1/3 with Milwaukee Road Family Fares. That's the route of the Superdome Hiawathas. Boy, I wish we could still ride in a Superdome Hiawatha.
Think about how good the food was.
It never occurred to me that the 747 with the little lounge dome thing is just an outgrowth of luxury train cars.
Oh, right.
Right?
Although if you're
fancy enough, your train car has a dome on
it's
top.
It's not, the view isn't quite as spectacular.
It is not.
Although maybe the view is of a lot more of America's splendor.
More view, but probably obscured by clouds. Thank you, Larry. These brochures are amazing.
Are we going to split those up depending on who likes what?
We're going to have a draft.
Okay.
But probably not on the air. How long is this show right now?
We're at 1 hour and 5 minutes.
It's still timely.
Yeah.
Let's do it. Let's do a draft of these brochures. The best way to support Omnibus is to send us old railway maps. Mm-hmm. But the second best way to support Omnibus is to go to patreon.com/omnibusproject. And for, what, a pittance?
Really? Hardly even a pittance.
What's less than a pittance? A sou?
$5.
A mere token?
What else can you buy for $5?
I mean, you can't even get a chili dog for $5 in Seattle.
No, but I guess there are plenty of things. You could buy a box of biodegradable plastic bags for $5, I bet. No, it's probably $7 for biodegradable ones.
I mean, a grocery store is full of things you can get for
$5. That's right. That's
but
true.
Is your entertainment universe full of things you can get for
$5? You can't go to a movie. You can't...
Hulu is now $18 a month if you don't want the ads.
Did you see that Amazon Prime is doing that too?
Yep.
Ads.
And I think there's maybe no way... I think you... Even if you're a Prime member, you get ads, right?
You do.
Is there a way to opt out of them?
$2.99 a month in addition to whatever you're already paying for Prime, which I'm sure is not nothing.
I'm going to pay less than $2.99 to get somebody to watch the ads for me. This is an arbitrage opportunity. If you want to watch ads for me for like $2.98,
mm-hmm.
I have a job for you.
Come on over.
Come
sit
on over.
In the chair that won't recline and watch ads for us.
For less than a third of what Hulu will cost you this month, you can now hear a bonus Omnibus episode. You can see photos on our Patreon page. There's other merchandise available that is going to be rolling out. In fact, you're listening to this in April, end of March, early April. It's probably already rolled out. Patreon just got better and better.
Patreon got better and better. Da-da-da-ba.
We've replaced it with our bio Patreon,
mm-hmm.
which now is
also not recyclable.
Smaller carbon footprint,
mm-hmm.
or larger, hard
depending,
to say.
Depending on how you feel about algal blooms.
So if you've got a couple extra coins jingling in your pocket right now and you enjoy Omnibus, now's the time to go to patreon.com Omnibus Project and become a supporter of the full Omnibus experience.
I've recently been working on my pedal board, my guitar pedal board,
mm-hmm.
which has got pedals on it that make the guitar sound different.
But set into a board.
Yeah, because I've been writing a lot of songs lately and getting ready to play some live music. Anyway, it's like my latest iteration of my midlife crisis. So if you have a bunch of guitar pedals lying around, in addition to supporting our Patreon, put all those guitar pedals in a box and send them to me.
You know what? You can do it instead. I will forfeit my half of this Patreon donation in order to reduce, reuse, recycle old guitar pedals.
Send those guitar... I know that some of you have guitar pedals just sitting around. You once upon a time had them and you don't use them anymore. Send them to me and I'll put them on a Long Winter's recording.
But everyone else, everybody who doesn't have a basement full of guitar pedals has to give to the Patreon.
That's right. Send us $5. Futurelings, from our vantage point in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word. But if providence allows, we wish you many goods and cheese.
And or cheese.
And the plastics that can be made from the recycling garbage water of cheese.
You got to reuse the goods and recycle the cheese.
That's right. We hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.